Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening to a delayed broadcast of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive, and it's every Friday we have Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam from Selma, Alabama. I think it is most appropriate that we have Religion Means Alive on Friday, the best day of the week, the best day in the Muslim calendar, the day that man was created, the day that man was sent to the earth, and the day that man will be resurrected. It is the day called Yawmul Jumma, the day of gathering. And we're honored and privileged, as always, to be on Fridays. And Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam, who is a first-rate scholar, first of Imam Waruddin Muhammad, and is a part of our Ulema, the learned. Also, Imam Yusuf Salam is a former law professor, so that makes him a scholar. But also, he's a practicing imam and a practicing attorney, and has been a practicing legislator. Of course, I don't think we have seen the end of his political career. I believe that's going to be resurrected. I don't know. But a man that has come into Selma, Alabama, no Muslims there besides him and his family, created a community development class. And lo and behold, there is the Selma Islamic Center. We're going to do everything in our power to cause the Selma Islamic Center to be the beacon light of Islam in America. And I believe it will be eventually a place that many of our southern friends will join us and learn and accept the religion of Al-Islam as taught by Ibn Baba.
I can't hear nothing, Kai. Did I lose it? I just keep hearing it saying muted and unmuted.
Okay, I was muted, sir. Yes, sir, you're right. I was muted. I was. You're right. I'm listening. I'm talking, but I'm not listening to myself. But I was going to say, in that great state of Alabama, that once dripped with nullification of human life, will rise a new political class that will be the beacon light for the United States and even the globe. And I believe that Imam Yusuf Salam represents that kind of practice, of political practice in theory, that will cause the black belt to reflect the human nature. And with those words, I'm going to ask him to give us a welcoming statement, and then we're going to go into an examination and see what case he would put before the world court and the defense and the matter of Imam Waruddin Muhammad and the resurrection of Bubba, further known in the information as the resurrection of Ham.
Let me just say, first of all, that we thank Almighty God, and this is not a religious broadcast, so I leave it at that, to have this opportunity to come before you. But being a son of the South, I really don't think Ham can be thoroughly resurrected without also an accompanying resurrection of Japan, the European Southerner. We went through slavery together in an adverse, disharmonized manner. Look how much we were contravention to each other in terms of human relationship. Jim Crowism, we went together. Now, God has blessed Ham to rise, and Japheth is declining, and he's so desperate that he allowed a queen-born carpetbagger to swing through the South like Sherman, get his vote, which helped him thrust forward toward the Republican nomination. And already he's acting like Southern Bubba Japheth does not even exist. Once again, who's going to stand and coalesce with Bubba? His leadership throughout history has always treated him like a cracker. His leadership in trailer trash. But this Ham was being born. Is not one who believe that get back is a screed MF. This Ham has come from the dispensation of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his son Imam Walter D. Muhammad under the tutelage of Farah Muhammad. We are civilizers. And a civilized tide lifts all boats. There's a future for New Africa throughout the South, serving as an example for our brothers all over the country. And we must make it happen. But we shouldn't turn against Japheth because he's in a dying state, sucking up opioids, killing himself, discouraged, looking for a white savior. Let's sit down and reason with him. We've been together in the South so long. You come upon hard times. Let's see, can't we work our problems out together? We are not separatists. We are not dominators. We make our prayer to the East. Our sentiments is for mercy and compassion to the human being, the universal, original human being that God created. And if Bubba can just release some of his fear, his insecurity, his artificiality, his grafted mindset that make him prone to the lower instinct of his racist nature sometimes, and reach out and see that Ham is with him, that Ham don't mean him no harm, that Ham has become a global civilizer, and we ready to be the vanguard of the human life right here in America. And we thank God for sending us a leader that could refine, evolve, and elevate our vision. Brother Imam, it's a pleasure to be in this strategic position. Are you civilized enough to reach down and try to now deal with the flip script where Japheth now is in the muck and the mire, and he needs the help of the descendants of Harriet Tubman folk to lift him up, to try to move him away from that Jacksonian mindset, where I got to dominate and kill off the red man. I got to make the African man a slave.
Brother Imam, mm-hmm. Will you stand by? We had one slight technical problem, and we're going to be back on the air. Are we straight out for it? Okay, good. All right, I'm sorry. Okay, I thought we were
Are you ready to be that kind of civilized? You certainly have the light. You certainly have the understanding. But, brother, do you have the disposition to be the leader in America, unequivocal leader, not dominator, but civilized leader for all the sons and daughters of God? That's the opening statement. That's what this thing is all about. That's what we're doing.
Well, it sounds as though you have given the preface to the Atlanta speech that Booker D. Washington gave at the Atlanta Exposition Center. Am I sensing some similarities in that speech pattern?
Yes, but we have high-tech it now. We giving it a high-tech tone. Same speech.
In other words, this is a Google Booker D. Washington. I'll be like, because you know in 1974, he gave a similar speech. And I think that we're looking at the speech. I'm ecstatic because I believe in that spirit that our next brother will be the Caucasian of the South. And William Faulkner alluded to that. We grew up with him. We fed him. My mother used to nurse him on our breast. Our mothers cooked for him. We're more than kissing cousins. We have become brothers in the struggle. And many of them were not slave masters. We need to understand that, too. They didn't have enough money to be slave masters. I think we're seeing a new mix. And I think that if we address that, brother, ma'am, we're going to form a new coalition. And it would seem to me.
Let me tell you, the Northeastern Corridor, and I don't want to talk about it, but the Caucasians out of that New York media elite have become really the most rotten force in America now. They think in their creative class, in their dominance, that they can force Donald Trump on the American people. They actually think they got that much media power, that much consensus molding power, public opinion shaping power to make us believe that all we heard for the last 12 months was an illusion. And now on a dime, there is a new Trump. Brother, it takes an arrogant, wicked mind to have that kind of low opinion of the intellect of their public. That's a blatant disregard of the intellect of their public. So we need to operate from a center that's not dominated by that. All the brothers up there in the game, they imitate that. They want to be a part of that. They want to be slick like that. And they're not rooted in that old-time religion. This is a generalization now. Certainly there are exceptions, but look how they operate. All metropolitan slick in the void of that old Southern soul power. They let the glamour of urban life strip them of the African-American people, most valuable asset in America, a soul that was chiseled and shaped and forged in the fires of slavery and Jim Crowism, a soul that's ready to lead the world. But you can't lead nothing with that Madison Avenue, Manhattan-type slickness. We got to bring it back home to the Rome. Get in touch again with that old-time religion that produced Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, Washington, Garvey, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm Shabazz, Dr. Martin Luther King, Mordecai Johnson, Vernon Johns, Benjamin May, praise. And above all, your man was his mama. He said that his mother raised him physically in the north, but she made sure that he never lost that southern soul. And he said, even though I'm physically in the north, I still consider myself a southerner, mean that I'm still in touch with my soulful roots that gave me the strength to survive the worst human treatment in the history of mankind. I prevail over thieves of animal state. I prevail over the whip. I prevail over the lynching, the castration. And now we stand in America ready to be the leaders of humanity because of that soul nature, not this artificial, slick urban mentality where we think we can wheel and deal now in the mundane world. Violating what was said by Johnson in our national anthem. He said, let us not get drunk with the wine of the world. I feel so sad when I observe my urban northern brothers and all of their artificiality and slickness. I could get to calling names, but I'm not going to do it. Brother, ma'am, the action still is with soul power that's connected with revealed cosmic signs. That's what you and I are standing on. That old-time soul power of our ancestors, but repeat with enlightenment, because we were taught by a man with a southern soul, but with universal enlightenment. Isn't that wonderful?
It is. It is indeed wonderful. I wanted to ask you a question that is sort of connected to the law and ask you about your fellow law school teacher. You were a law professor. I'm speaking of none other than Michelle Alexander. I was shocked to learn that Michelle Alexander is the wife of a federal prosecutor, but yet she bemoans the fact that there's mass incarceration as though her hands and her husband's hands is innocent. Also, the fact is, I think Michelle Alexander herself was a prosecutor. So I don't understand why suddenly she's making a big deal out of imprisonment of people. And I'm not for mass. If people commit crimes, then they should belong in prison. I mean, hey, you know, especially I don't want people to be violent. There are super predators. Let's face that. That's the first thing. I pose as a question and ask you to challenge it if I'm wrong.
I can't challenge that.
I think when one keep going out of jail, there's a man right now on trial in Essex County. I won't try his case because he is innocent to proven guilty. I believe that. But this man was seen on camera beating this Caucasian lady like she was a rag doll. So he sits in court now, innocent looking, with glasses. He looks like a college professor. Well, as I was telling someone, his lawyer is obligated to give him a vigorous defense. And he's doing a vigorous defense. But this man had been guilty, found guilty by a jury of his peers, on four occasions of beating women like that, invading their homes. Now, you mean to tell me this man, am I wrong to assume that this man is a super predator?
That is an irrebuttable presumption, no doubt about it. Every people, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of pigmentation, are producing their culture and their life super predators. Even in the old days of the South, when we had basically a non-criminal aura in our community, there were some individuals who were super predators. There's no doubt about that. So now, I don't have a problem with identifying that fact, but also the elite in a community can eat the flesh of their brothers like vultures. I don't have a problem with any African-American professional family having divergent ends in terms of their professional careers. I read a statement from her. She said her and her husband disagree on this matter. But I do have a problem when the professional class in the African-American community, after all representatives met in Gary, Indiana in 1972, studied the problems, wrote a position paper on the problem, acknowledged that a fire was beginning to blaze in the African-American community. And how did they respond to these? How did they respond to this study? Well, Jesse left crying Nation Time. Don't read the notes. He closed it out with Nation Time. And most of those community leaders left, went back to their community, went into politics, got on a professional career track, and forgot about the insinuation that was occurring in our community. The early 70s, Brother Imam, two decades before the passing of that bill, there are some problems with mass incarceration. We have both acknowledged that. The problem I have with both Michelle Alexander and her spouse, and most of the African-American professional elite, they ignored the pie in the community, and they wouldn't join together with the masses the way we did in the 60s. The elite out there in the streets with the masses saying we should overcome. They got a little opportunity and forgot about Drano on fire back home. Moved away from the community, took their money, took their resources, and turned their back on a community ablaze. By that I mean young brothers out there trying to make a dollar, unskilled, not ready for the cybernetic age. See, they were talking about this cybernetic age in the late 60s. I read about it.
Yeah, but they call it the technical revolution. That's exactly right. And Future Shock. Dr. King, that's right.
They were talking about that. And so our brothers, as this economy transition, this unskilled labor that we were known for and was good at and was productive and feeding families with, the economy changed. So the brothers started slanging out there in the streets, being led by their appetites, unchecked by knowledge, Brother Imam. A Pinocchio situation where their nose caught on fire, their fiery appetites began to blaze, and all the moral structure in our community was dissipated to a great extent, and there was no water to put out the fire. Why is it that our professional class did not respond to the pleas of Imam Muhammad in the mid-70s when this thing was just a little fire? And if we had reacted collectively, we could have very easily put out the fire. Well, this is historical reality. If you're going to point the finger at the system and the law, you at least ought to have the moral integrity and the sense of responsibility to point out our own internal failures. It's two realities, externalities and internalities. A weak, corrupt elite, not concerned about the masses, love to play on the externalities, what the system and institutional racism is doing toward us. And some of that exists. But what about the internal dynamics in our community, where we have the ability to shape events and forces that can lead us to an excellent destiny? Are we completely helpless, the people that went through slavery and Jim Crowism, fighting this thing? Now all of a sudden we told victims to some kind of statutory provision. I can't buy that.
Brother Imam, if you were a follower, it would seem to me if one were a follower of Minister Malcolm Shabazz, as they, many of our people claim, most every African American from the ages of, say, 40 on up has an autobiography of Malcolm X and know he isn't claiming to be a hero. Wouldn't it be logical for those persons to be inquisitive about what Malcolm pointed toward Imam Dean Muhammad?
Not only that, they can study his life before he went to prison and how he almost burned himself out there with a personal incineration. Then he had to be incarcerated. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave him the moral, watery foundation, moral sensitivity, where he stopped those actions that, according to his statement, had reduced him to a vicious animal level. So first of all, if they're showing to Malcolm, they should be out there crying, look at Brother Malcolm and how the moral waters of the Nation of Islam put out his fire. And let's recommend what Elijah Muhammad did for Malcolm to all our young brothers. If they really knew Malcolm, what they remember about Malcolm. All that fiery, heated gun power by coming out the barrel rhetoric. All that talk about self-defense and aggression and weapons. The imagery. So they identify with that fire from Malcolm. But they don't identify with that which really made Malcolm the moral reform program of the Nation of Islam. And because he was morally reformed, he could see greater spiritual and moral excellence in another individual. He saw himself, but he knew that he could not match Imam Waruddin Muhammad as his brother in the nation and friend. He couldn't compete with the man, Imam, in terms of moral excellence nor spiritual excellence. And I do respect him for having a script to point to the Imam as his spiritual mentor. They'll read that book 1,000 times and they act like that statement is not in there. It's blatant. It's obvious. It's clear. So, look how far I followed our dearly beloved brother. Unfortunately, the widow ended up in an untimely and tragic fiery death. The grandson ended up with firepower in Mexico. Too much fire, brother, man. We need some water.
Yeah, but
are you still there?
The widow also, before she passed, did say that Imam Waruddin Muhammad and an African-American-owned radio station, formerly owned by the African-American, I have to say that, that went up in smoke. Fire, not smoke, fire to Goldman Sachs. WLIB, the inner city broadcast, is no longer owned by African Americans. But
on that broadcast,
Sister Betty said that Imam Waruddin Muhammad is the best of us. So if you, if one is an African American, think of Michelle Alexander, Angela Davis, all who claim to love Malcolm. At least they could have done what Stevie Wonder and Kwame Ture did. They at least came to hear Imam Muhammad. Lola Falana did come to hear Imam Muhammad. These people, to my knowledge, and Michelle Alexander is probably old enough to have at least been in the lifetime to hear Imam Muhammad. They ignored him. You know, it's really, to me, the Cornel Wests of the world. Imam Muhammad sent people to talk to West, and it would seem the West would have reached out to Imam Muhammad, but he didn't. So I'm really beginning more and more, and I have worked among this class. I am almost preparing an indictment against them. I have not yet come to a conclusion, but there seem to be that they are part of a conspiracy to keep, either by ignoring, negligently, or criminally, on a social level, to keep this message away from our people. You know, I heard them talk, and I heard some of them, I was in the presence of one recently, big-time African-American in the law. And he's talking about the greatness of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who was great. However, this man is a partner at one of the biggest law firms and one of the biggest African-Americans in the legal profession. If I say any more about it, you probably know who he is. But I never heard him mention Imam Muhammad that made it possible for him really to be at this big law firm, to be a big figure that they call out for inquiries. But yet, privately over drinks or over a meal, he would tell you about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but they ignore the greatest champion of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Imam Waqtin Muhammad. But Imam, what do you say about that kind of thinking?
Well, let me just use my experience. There's never been a man that became educated in the highest principles of civilized order from our community that was not trained somewhat in academia. Follow me now. In academia, you get a training, but you are conditioned to follow your own vain impulse. There's nothing that carry over grandmama and grandmama's and mama's little statement growing up, all of my footsteps in the Lord, meaning follow the guidance of God. Once that class leave the church and get trained academically, they lose faith in the church and they throw out the guidance of God. So then they're left with their own impulse toward guidance. And they really can't respect the man who was educated. But the more he was educated, the more he relied on the guidance of God. They're not looking for the guidance of God. If I had not ran across Imam Muhammad as I completed law school, Brother Imam, I may have ended up in the same predicament. But my knowledge orientation changed when I started listening to a man being educated and taught by the guidance of God. So I started imitating that. So these people get out there with their own mind, their own theory. If there was a real, genuine, deep love for the masses, they would understand, look, my own human intelligence is limited. I'm not omniscient. My understanding is limited. These problems the masses of our people have are too big for my intellect. I need a bigger mind. I need the omniscient mind. Not only do I need an omniscient mind behind me, I need an omnipotent power power behind me so I can have the conviction to sincerely work with others to solve the problems of my people. So the man who understood that he was under the guidance of God also respected the power of God so he could genuinely go out, advocate, and attempt to meet the challenge of the problem of our people. Our African-American educated elite, check their biography. Many of them grew up deeply in the church. Many of them had big deacons and trustees and preachers in their family. Got up and went to these little ivory towers and didn't want to hear nothing else. This is a generalization about the guidance of God. Go and read any book by Brother Dyson, Brother West, and find where they explicitly and unequivocally, without compromise, advocate the fact, look, I'm giving you the guidance of God here. This is what we need to do as a people. They go and run down all their little vain impulse to knowledge. So that's where we are. We can't expect anything from this class as long as they have rejected the guidance of God.
To my knowledge, not any of those men have even mentioned God in that work, other than in passing with Mr. Dyson. And I hate to tell you, I hate to also tell you that I find Mr. Dyson almost virtually impossible to read. But I attempted to read Between God and Gangsta Rap, and I found very little between or above to read in his work. This man is an ordained preacher, and it would seem to me you would see in his work the mention of God, neither him or West.
I recently looked at that book, and I just didn't see any analysis that was rooted in the guidance of God. I recently saw a new book by Professor Henry Louis Gates, a total
mundane, non-sacred view of our history, African-American history, says the death of Dr. King. One little blurb in there. 1975, Imam Muhammad succeeds his father. And that's it. And I had the unmitigated gall to put a picture, big picture, Minister Farrakhan right above that blurb. He may be skillfully trained at Harvard, but he's totally separated from the drift of our history, the people
and
seeking after.
I hate to out him. I hope he's not listening, but if he is, he does just listen. But Professor Eddie Glaude, I just read a book by him, and I'm going to review it, called Democracy and Black. And Professor Glaude was a member of the Nation of Islam, and he seems to launder his past by ignoring even he was in the new Neo Nation of Islam, Minister Farrakhan Nation of Islam, which I make a distinction. There's no mention of anything about Islam in his work or Imam Muhammad. You know what I hate to say, Brother Man? Am I wrong to say these men are dishonest or disingenuous? Because it seemed to me when they ignored this, and yet in New Day in Babylon, the Caucasian author opens his book with the passing of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Imam Muhammad taking over the reign of leadership. He says the end of the Black Power era was the day that Don Elijah Muhammad was put in the grave. Now, why did the Caucasian or a Taylor Branch can see this and Skip Gates, Bell Hooks, Derrick Bell, and all these men who are in the African American community never mention Imam Muhammad. What do you make of that?
What did the Imam make of it? You forgotten what he said about Lerone Bennett? Said he respected his work, but he was disappointed with his hypocrisy.
He used some stronger words than that, didn't he? Will you please give us over?
You
used
that
in a public announcement. He said he had, I had forgotten, but he blasted him. Can you tell us in words and substance? Substance is not words. What Imam Muhammad said about Lerone Bennett Jr.
Well, you're going to have to share with me with that task because I don't remember the exact quote. But his point was he was a man in Chicago, a so-called scholar. And in his work, he failed to deal with not only Imam Muhammad, but in a big way, the history of the Nation of Islam. And Imam blasted him for that. Now, I don't remember the language, the hot language that you remember. If so, why don't you share that with the audience?
I can't remember the exact word, but when you said that, it brought back to me, because I'd happen to have been in that audience. He used some words that we would perhaps use in the pool room or worse. And all meant be, but he called it something. I mean, you know, it's the height of dishonesty on the part of these men.
He hit it hard. There is a systematic effort among African American intellectuals to write Imam Muhammad out of history. I'm gonna just be honest with you. Most have attempted to write him out of history. None have done a serious investigation of his life work and reported on it in any rigorous intellectual way. It's disappointing, Brother Imam, but that's a fact. That's a fact. So the question becomes, the pertinent inquiry becomes, the frame issue becomes, why is it that these leading African-American rights have decided collectively, implicitly conspired to leave Imam Muhammad out of our African-American historical experience?
That is a very, very good question. I just don't have any answer for it. I want to turn our attention now to another tragic death. A man that I didn't pay very much attention to, but I encourage him being a part of the culture I did know. The passing of Prince. What do you make of that, and what implications is that for our public?
Look, it's been wall-to-wall coverage. Brother Imam, you know I try to be straight up with Prince. Okay, there's been wall-to-wall coverage. Now, let me say this. Prince was a human being. I don't buy into icons. His family is grieving. And I'm not going to say anything to personally demean him individually right now. I could, but I'm not going to do that. All I can say is that there have been satanic powers in the West that have offered our talented people in music the same deal that they allegedly offered Robert Johnson at the crossroad, that great blues man from the Mississippi Delta. That's the test that they put them all under. But what kind of culture do you have that would blast a man of music for over 36 hours on the air, and a spiritual giant lives in his own, in this same culture, and he was lucky to get 10 minutes randomly in certain places? It's a bad society that would do that. You couldn't see the imam on television when he passed. More or less wall-to-wall coverage. We need to think about that. What are they trying to get us to do? Maybe if Bill Cosby hadn't made his move, maybe when he passed, they'd have had him on wall-to-wall like they have Prince. But if you don't allow yourself to be cloned and rubber stamp 100% with a copycat Western mind, no matter how clean and righteous you are, evidently there's no room for you. So your whole life must be stonewalled. That's what I see in the treatment of Imam Walter D. Muhammad. And again, I'm not going to say anything about Prince at this point personally. He just passed. And he's human. He has a final family connection. He has friends who loved him. And there's no need of whipping in it or taking out the lash right now. So I'm going to bypass that and say that I'm not one given to idol worship. I don't believe in celebrities. Imam Muhammad is not a celebrity. Prophet Muhammad told us he was a flesh and blood human being. I'm not an idol. I'm not an icon. I'm not a celebrity. The whole idea of celebrityship is foreign to my thinking after being schooled by the late Imam Walter D. Muhammad. So I will say I'm not caught up in all this iconic grief. There's no way.
I have great respect for Prince, and what I've heard privately, I can't verify it, that Imam Muhammad, well, I have heard him say he had a lot of admiration for Prince, and I heard he'd gone backstage, and I actually had heard that Prince...
Well, I disagree with that. I'm sorry. I just can't. I don't care if Muhammad said it. I disagree with that. Now,
yes,
don't
sir.
Let me have to get in while I say why.
Yes, sir.
Now,
okay.
I love Imam, and most of what he said I agree with. But he's not God, and I'm not going to rubber stamp everything he said. There's no way I could admire Prince.
Yes, sir.
No way.
I found that pretty rough myself.
Huh?
I found that one to be a very rough one myself. I mean, because we know that there's Imam Muhammad and then that Wallace Muhammad. So
Wallace Muhammad was a very generous man.
Right.
And he would always say a word to the right about anybody. I've heard him make statements about lesser people in Prince that was generous, that was not demeaning. So I understand him, but to try to elevate that to some absolute posture in terms of social evaluation of the role of Prince, Jane Brown, or any other statement. I heard him make good statements about Jane Brown. You heard him too.
Yes, sir.
But on the scale of totality, that does not mean Jane Brown was good for the masses of our people.
No, sir. I happen to agree with you. I have that. I accept that. I'm going to tell you, I'm not familiar with the career or Prince or the music of Prince. I just haven't paid it very little attention.
I don't want to get into any specifics. The brother has passed away, what have you. But the enemy of our people have used these artists to destroy the morals of the minds of our people. And they can make a trillion records. I'm not going to admire that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I would agree with you, Billy, ma'am. I don't.
Listen to this. How would I look like critiquing Michelle Alexander, who just got an intellectual position? She don't have access to the souls of millions of folk. And I'm going hypocritically on your show critique her situation and then blast out, "I admire Prince." No, sir, brother. That'll never happen.
Yes, sir. I got you. I don't want to spend much more time on Prince or any other cultural figures. I would like to now turn our attention to the burn. It seems that the burn has burnt out. What did you make of that? That is.
Senator Sanders may have burned out politically, but he has not burned out spiritually. What do I mean by that? He's put on the garb spiritually now of being the scourge of God. All the political figures in American democracy, President Obama, Senator Clinton, all of them are corrupt whores. It is up to me as the scourge of God to come and scourge these sinners. And even though I'm burned out politically, I am that I am. And if they don't watch me, I'll go to their convention and destroy it and tear it up if I don't get my way. So he's a goner politically. But look what he just said yesterday. Even if politically this woman has more votes than I have, more delegates than I have, right, by the end of next week after she come out of New Jersey and Maryland, not New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and one or two more, she may be approaching 280 to 300 delegates more than Bernie Sanders. 2.5 million votes in early May of 2008. The late Tim Russert, after Obama won the North Carolina primary, he said that the election was over, that the nomination would go to Obama. Obama only had, at most, 110 delegate lead over Senator Clinton. Okay? By May, she'll have close to 300, maybe. Three times as many that Obama had, President Obama had over her. You didn't hear her talking about we gonna end up with a contested convention. I'm gonna go in there and flip superdelegates. Look over here. These superdelegates been around. They have been intertwined with the Clintons for years. Even if he was close to her in both of those categories, they wouldn't flip for him. And they certainly not going to flip for him with that kind of massive vote total lead and delicate lead. So what is he talking about? It's going to be a contested convention. He's saying as the scourger, as the I am God, if I don't get it, nobody gets it. And he can do great damage to Senator Clinton's potential to defeat Donald Trump in November. Now, how many good faith people are going to sit around and watch that. I see him as a revelation. A lot of people in the West claim that they can't see Jacob, that they don't understand that that's anti-Semitic. If you want to see Jacob, study the attitude of Bernie Sanders. And you can see him in his arrogance, in his presumptuousness, in his insolence, in his self-righteousness. I'm chosen to scourge the Democratic Party. Man, please. I've been out there in the game. All of you want that money to get reelected.
What do you make of the Republican Party and whether Mr. Trump is going to make the has the sufficient numbers to clinch the nomination if he does? The second part of the question was, if he does...
They've already made a deal, in my opinion. If he get out and fake it like he a new Trump, they're going to allow him to have it. Now, the Caucasian male can no longer produce a legitimate world-class statesman. Let me go back to Roosevelt, to Truman, to Eisenhower, to Kennedy, even Nixon, Carter, Reagan, and even to a lesser extent, the two Bushes. Those men did not act presidential. Bill Clinton, all of them, those people were actual political skilled people. They didn't think like they were political leaders. They were. Donald Trump is an apprentice actor. They telling him to perform. They don't like the fact that Ham took over. And now they can't find a real leader, so they gonna force an actor on the American people. Whether you like him or not, Lyndon Baines Johnson was for real. He learned how to twist arms in the U.S. Senate for decades. He was a master inside legislative prayer. John F. Kennedy was a perceptive, mercurial political genius. Bill Clinton had an IQ of 186, one of the most skilled politicians in the history of this country. They were producing leaders. Their big tree of political leadership has dried up. They didn't get the message when the Creator went to the Samaritans, the African-American people, to get a president. Now he going to their women because none of them are ready. I challenge you and any listeners in your audience, other than possibly John Kasich, but he got a lot of problems, a Caucasian that's out there now that's anywhere near ready to lead the free world, any male. They don't have it, so we will manufacture one. But that's artificial. And the American people want real leadership. Like it or not, this woman has developed political acumen, know-how, and skills over the years. She's not a political actor. Even Ronald Reagan was not a political actor. He had been a governor of California. You're going to take this apprentice and force him on us. Why? There's no leadership out there. A lot of them dried it up.
What would you make it president if Trump were to become president of the United States?
It would only stave off the inevitable. The browning of America.
Is there any connection to Mr. Trump's possibility of being president and the possibility that Saudi Arabia said it would remove if America sues Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia is prepared to remove $800 billion, I want to repeat to the audience, $800 billion out of the American economy. What would that mean for us, and what would that mean for the world, if that is true?
We know that would be devastating, but let me answer your question. Let's look at this thing in terms of political reality. What can Trump do in a global, interconnected world? Do you think that he can mess with all Muslims? Do you think that he can deport all those Mexican people or Latinos? Do you think that he can do any of these things? Do you think he's going to pass out nuclear bombs like candy bars? Do you think he's going to overrule the U.S. military and make them engage in blatant violation of international law? What's the most Trump is going to do? Get up there and play games and shuck and jive, and the media go act like he's really doing something because he's a Caucasian male. If he see that bub in the South have figured him out and for re-election, they won't run and vote for him again, then he gonna do something crazy to try to win them back. Then some of this little racist, nativist, genoistic rhetoric might be put into play if he got to do something to win re-election. That's when he's going to become dangerous. If they would allow him to play act to become president to get the power, when does that stop? When it comes to him retaining power. Go back to this strategy of the ends justify the means. That's when he has the potential to be dangerous. When he look up and see, hey, these people figure out I'm jiving them, my approval rating is going down, I'll never get reelected, and then he'll do something crazy to try to satisfy his base bubble again. That's his danger.
My question becomes, if he were elected, I have some indication that he won't serve. But one of the things I'm interested
in. Man, that's
knowing,
a bunch of crap. What are these fellas getting all that foolishness? You think these people going through all this trouble to play these games, to marshal their media forces, to try to change reality? Just to get him, man, he won't serve. It's powerful forces behind this man. And they have a reason why they want him there.
What I'm wondering is, and I'm not prepared to argue either way. I'm just telling you I've heard this from some high
judge. Well, I am. And according to law, he'll say him with a grain of salt.
Yes, sir. Let me ask you this. Do you think he can beat the Senator Hillary Clinton?
No, I don't. Because the Obama coalition, when Obama get out there, President Obama, when Michelle get out there, when Biden get out there, there's an article that was in the paper on the 16th. The Republican strategy has been dependent upon the demographic of the aging white male. There's an article now saying that strategy may have been ill-conceived because they're dying off at a rapid rate. Hispanics are resisting. Muslims are resisting big time. If the Democrats are not weak and soft now, after years of all of them being in these positions, these black legislative people all over the country, if they go out and do their job and gin up their base, how can Trump do what Mitt Romney couldn't do and John McCain couldn't do when Obama coalition is larger now in numbers and potential? But that doesn't mean that the media is not going to do everything, those forces, to do everything in their power to try to make Americans think the Trump that they saw in the primaries was a delusion. That there's another Trump So why would they do that? Some want him in power. Others want a horse race. Being able to tell the people, look, Hillary leads Trump by 2 points in the poll. Keep excitement all the way in November to gin up the ratings. Ginning up the ratings, gin up the resources. These media people saw what happened to Al Jazeera. Went off the air. They saw Olivette Belcher had a job that used to be on CNN. They saw David Schuster and Tony Harris sitting in ankle seats, had a job, and all of a sudden, Al Jazeera folded and they out of work. People don't know, before Jeff Zucker made a deal of CNN with Donald Trump, who sponsored him or produced him with The Apprentice, that he would turn CNN over to Donald Trump. CNN was waffling in terms of his future. Same thing about NSNBC. Bill Griffin, the student of Jeff Zucker, okay, made a swift purge at NSNBC. Sharpton been reduced. Melissa Ash Perry gone. Terry gone. Ed Schultz gone. All these folks that wouldn't go along with the Trump game, they've been purged. How did Zucker get these ratings? When Donald Trump had a confrontation with Megyn Kelly, in order for Fox to keep his credibility with his people, they had to back Kelly. And they started fighting Trump. And many of the obsessive Fox listeners became angry and went to CNN and went to MSNBC because they were playing Trump all the time. That's how their ratings jacked up. Then, when Fox saw what was happening, Roger Ailes said, look, we got to do something about this. So they sent Megyn Kelly to a meeting with Donald Trump. What you think that meeting was all about? To reduce the tensions, to try to win back over those Fox viewers that abandoned them pursuing CNN when Zucker was giving Trump 24/7 coverage. From the time he made a speech in the morning to the time he made a speech at night, every last minute was shown on CNN. The people that study these matters, they'll tell you that the deal that Zucker made with his boy Trump is what made Trump rise before the American people. Not you brothers up in New Jersey, not you white folks up there, not the New Yorkers, but the masses of American people. The 1/3 to 40% that support him. To this day, only in New York City, the Republican Party of Carl Paladino, a man who advocates horse bestiality, they gave him the nomination for governor. A wild, crazy freak. He was a Republican nominee for governor in New York. There's not a Republican Party in the South that's as weird and crazy as the Republican Party in New York. This man went to his home state and won under those circumstances, and they trying to push the idea that somehow that makes him a political god. The fact that Ted Cruz outmaneuvered him from Colorado, Wyoming, Wisconsin, wore him out in 5 states, outmaneuvering him in terms of delegates. All that was supposed to be forgotten with a vote of a party that only has 2 million in New York and half of them are crazy as a duty bug.
Yes, sir, brother. Brother Imam, do you see Mr. Trump locking up the nomination for the Republicans? Is there a chance?
Well, a deal has been made. The deal, in my opinion, was made in Miami, in Florida, yesterday. They won't fake it. I see a question on the TV today. Will there be a Trump and Cruz ticket? Trump said,
wow,
not likely. Not likely. Man, Donald Trump, if that was not a possibility, you know what Trump would have said. Not likely. Which does not eliminate the possibility. There's already a deal in the works. And all three media outlets are in on it. Yes, he's going to get the nomination.
Without any
probably without a contested
all.
Convention.
There won't be a contested convention, you're saying?
No, sir. They done made a deal.
Well, I tell you, I tell everybody to tune in to this broadcast for one of the wisest political persons among us. Is Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. I sit back and listen. And I, like I said, I'm not easy to be impressed or to be convinced, but I do weigh facts. And last week when you talked with me, you have a cool, rational sense of logic, and you have certainly convinced me when we were talking about the founding father, President Jefferson, as you all say in the law, that equity outweighs all the other factors in the, and I think when we look at Mr. The president, founding father, Mr. Jefferson, I now can see your point. If you look at
earlier this week, before the Monday night, before the New York primary, Rachel Maddow did a segment, 15 minutes, showing the peculiarities in the weirdness of the Republican Party in New York. I didn't mention half the stuff that Carl Paladino did leading up to his receiving the nomination. Notwithstanding all of that, they gave him the nomination. If you look at the picture of Trump on Victory Night, what mayor was standing right behind him? Carl Paladino. I'm giving you the facts. What Rachel was saying in her sleek, wise way, hey, this election in New York for Trump is not going to be as big as we're making it out to be. That's when I picked up and began to understand what was happening. Brother, we know that none of us have prophetic-type prognosticating powers. I would be shocked out of my political shoes if they have not already made a deal. And what they tell him, you don't have to change, just present a new image so we won't look so bad when we bag off from you, the Republican establishment. We'll stop messing with the rules. We'll tamp down on that. But it would be embarrassing for us to do that with your old image. So they hired Manafort to bring the manna from heaven, to bring forth the manna, the professional slickness to give a supernatural charge to that strategy to try to brainwash the people that there's a new Trump. They saving face because they made a deal with him. And if you say, I thought you all said you would never support Trump. Then they look at him, he's changed. So we can change our position.
Yes, sir. I certainly see your point. Well, I wanted to bring some news to the public in ask you, what do you make of, you're a man of read signs. My son, Alfred Y. Muhammad, has been accepted at the great Morehouse University, the place where Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. and Jr., and the place where Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays presided over so many years, and where Dr. Howard K. Thurman. What does this pretend? His acceptance.
Let me say, first of all, congratulations to Brother Alfred. Go on with your bad self. Stay humble and keep God out in front. And may you be blessed to be a leader and a force at Morehouse, to bring back that kind of template of leadership that was so beneficial to African-American people in our history. Brother, we have confidence that you can do it. Go down and look for other sharp minds and good character. Form groups. Study like the young students of SNCC did. Stand for something that's bigger than self and narrow-minded professional ambition. And let me tell you, young man, not only you, but your cohorts can be a shining example for our younger generations as we move further into the 21st century. I look for the challenge. Brother, ma'am, your son is going to be in my territory. And I promise you that I'm going to leave the black belt and go up and visit him and share with him. Give him a dime or two every now and then. Love him. Let him know what he stands for, how he can carry the torch of the Imam leadership for another generation. I'm so pleased and happy about this new development. And let me say to you and your wife, the sister, as parents, you have been blessed. And I know you understand the importance of this development in your family. And we'll make dua that everything work out well and he can make you all proud the way the Imam made Sister Clara and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad proud. That should be our dua. No envy, no jealousy, none of that, no covetousness, but a sincere wish that this young man fulfill his potential, and I can see it now. He's gifted as a leader, and may he grow with that.
He's interested in following in your footsteps and being a lawyer, a practicing attorney, and he has aspirations for one of the highest levels of these United States. I'm urging him, as I urge a lot of young people, to be prepared to move to the homeland. The southern states is our homeland. I know we've been up north, and I have enjoyed myself in the north. But really, when you think about it, we have a great potential in the south.
We have that potential in the south. And,
yes, I think there's more potential in the south for the African-American to develop in the United States and anywhere in the world. Would you agree or disagree with me?
They say 100 years ago in Selma, that was the Great Migration. I agree, Brother Ma'am. 100 years later, there needs to be a systematic reverse migration back to the south. Now, you and I don't have the ability to make that happen alone. But if our people were wise, we would start moving some of our masses out of these hell holes in our urban areas, organizing our people, planning, developing the South, laying an infrastructure for the coming of a reverse migration. Brother, ma'am, that's one of the wisest suggestions we both really have discussed on this show is needed. The cost of living is too great up north. One bedroom apartment.
I think Allah is forcing us back. I think the force, because if you really look at it, as I told you, a one bedroom apartment in New York City, Brooklyn, which used to be the slums. And I'm just reading a book called The Ghetto. I'm reviewing it, and we're going to have this author on our show. New book just came out, and I would recommend it highly to you. It is called Ghetto, author of Subway, Mitch Dunier, the Invention of a Place, the History of an Idea. And in it, there's a discussion of Horace Caton and a discussion of St. Cloud Drake, as well as others, and I just don't really see the great potential in these northern cities. And as I said, I have become cityfied. I thank Almighty God that I haven't become a city slicker, but I've been surrounded by city slickers. It just seems to me that the place where many of us still even have land, from Virginia on down to Florida, but particularly in Alabama and Georgia, where we're in large numbers, in South Carolina, where we all it would take is a small migration, just our retired people. I'm going to push this on the air. If we were to retire in Alabama, because, I mean, frankly, if you're making $1,000 a month, you can't afford these northern cities. If you're getting $2,000 a month, I know people in my neighborhood that are paying that much money in taxes, $1,000. Imagine this, paying $1,000 a month in taxes. But one could sell their home, take the $200,000, and live beautifully in the South and contribute to the South. And I'm going to bring up another issue while we're in the South. I'm thinking about places like Selma University. Our people, they have land there. If that college would sell some of that land to retirement villages and assist to live in the vision, there's a lot of creative things we could do if we design. I think that's where leadership comes in at. I think our Southern brothers, Caucasian brothers, will not be hostile because we're not asking anybody to move from a place. This is where we came from. If the Alabamians that are stuck in these big cities were to move back to Alabama, and don't bring your unraised children, unraised grandchildren, going to cause a tax problem and convert you, Brother Imam, with a being a prosecutor or may even fat in your pocket to be a defense lawyer. We don't want that kind of stuff. But we want progressive, good, decent people to come back home. Just straight up, come home. That's all. The South is our homeland. Would you not agree?
Well, I certainly agree with that. And, of course, we know there are pragmatic logistical challenges. But, you know, let's think about it. Let's advocate it. And let's see what happens. Brother Imam, we've been going now for almost an hour and a half. And
yes, sir.
Maybe you can close us out, if you will, with what you normally put on me. A good, strong closing statement. I've enjoyed it.
Yes,
and
sir,
what have you.
And pray. We've taxed you. We don't want to overtax you. You're a practicing attorney, practicing imam, practicing businessman. We're going to have you practicing, relaxing. We thank you. We thank our noble and honorable listening audience and our host, a gracious host. And we ask Almighty God blessings and mercy upon our audience, upon our host, upon all of you who are in radio land. Until next week at 7 o'clock. And we will be on tomorrow. We will be interviewing Playtell Benjamin. And we're going to be back on the air every day by God's permission. What religion means alive. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. But I must remind you that on May 1st in Hazelcrest, Illinois, I will deliver an address called The Joseph People Making Black Lives Matter in Hazelcrest, Illinois, the first Sunday. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. Peace be on you and good evening to you. Thank you, Brother Imam.
Thank you.